There are two sides to every issue. One side is right and the other is wrong. But the middle is always evil. The man who is wrong still retains some respect for truth, if only by accepting the responsibility of choice. But the man in the middle is the knave, who blanks out the truth in order to pretend that no choice or values exists, who is willing to sit out the course of any battle, willing to cash in on the blood of the innocent or to crawl on his belly to the guilty, who dispenses justice by condemning both the robber and the robbed to jail, who solves conflicts by ordering the thinker and the fool to meet each other halfway. In any compromise between food and poison, it is only death that can win. In any compromise between good and evil, it is only evil that can profit. In that transfusion of blood which drains the good to feed the evil, the compromiser is the transmitting rubber tube. You, who are half rational, half coward, have been playing a con game with reality, but the victim you have conned is yourself. When men reduce their virtues to the approximate, then evil acquires the force of an absolute. When loyalty to an unyielding purpose is dropped by the virtuous, it's picked up by scoundrels, and you get the indecent spectacle of a cringing, bargaining, traitorous good and a self-righteously uncompromising evil. As you surrendered to the mystics of muscle when they told you that ignorance consists of claiming knowledge, so now you surrender to them when they shriek that immorality consists of pronouncing moral judgment. When they yell that it is selfish to be certain that you are right, you hasten to assure them that you're certain of nothing. When they shout that it's immoral to stand on your convictions, you assure them that you have no convictions whatever. When the thugs of Europe's people states snarl that you are guilty of intolerance because you don't treat your desire to live and their desire to kill you as a difference of opinion, you cringe and hasten to assure them that you are not intolerant of any horror. When some barefoot bum in some pest hole of Asia yells at you, "How dare you be rich?" you apologize and beg him to be patient, and promise him you'll give it all away. You have reached the blind alley of the treason you committed when you agreed that you had no right to exist. Once you believed it was only a compromise. You conceded it was evil to live for yourself, but moral to live for the sake of your children. Then you conceded that it was selfish to live for your children, but moral to live for your community. Then you conceded that it was selfish to live for your community, but moral to live for your country. Now, you are letting this greatest of countries be devoured by any scum from any corner of the earth, while you concede that it is selfish to live for your country, and that your moral duty is to live for the globe. A man who has no right to life, has no right to values, and will not keep them. At the end of your road of successive betrayals, stripped of weapons, of certainty, of honor, you commit your final act of treason, and sign your petition of intellectual bankruptcy. While the muscle mystics of the people states proclaim that they're the champions of reason and science, you agree, and hasten to proclaim that faith is your cardinal principle, that reason is on the side of your destroyers, but yours is the side of faith. To the struggling remnants of rational honesty, in the twisted, bewildered minds of your children, you declare that you can offer no rational argument to support the ideas that created this country, that there is no rational justification for freedom, for property, for justice, for rights, that they rest on a mystical insight and can be accepted only on faith, that in reason and logic the enemy is right, but faith is superior to reason. You declare to your children that it is rational to loot, to torture, to enslave, to expropriate, to murder, but that they must resist the temptations of logic and stick to the discipline of remaining irrational. That skyscrapers, factories, radios, airplanes were the products of faith and mystic intuition, while famines, concentration camps, and firing squads are the products of a reasonable manner of existence. That the Industrial Revolution was the revolt of the men of faith against that era of reason and logic, which is known as the Middle Ages. Simultaneously, in the same breath, to the same child, you declare that the looters who rule the people's states will surpass this country in material production, since they are the representatives of science, but that it's evil to be concerned with physical wealth, and that one must renounce material prosperity. You declare that the looters' ideals are noble, but they do not mean them, while you do, that your purpose in fighting the looters is only to accomplish their aims, which they cannot accomplish, but you can, and that the way to fight them is to beat them to it and give one's wealth away. Then you wonder why your children join the people's thugs, or become half-crazed delinquents. You wonder why the looters' conquests keep creeping closer to your doors. and you blame it on human stupidity, declaring that the masses are impervious to reason. You blank out the open public spectacle of the looters' fight against the mind, and the fact that their bloodiest horrors are unleashed to punish the crime of thinking. You blank out the fact that most mystics of muscle started out as mystics of spirit, that they keep switching from one to the other, that the men you call materialists and spiritualists are only two halves of the same dissected human, forever seeking completion, but seeking it by swinging from the destruction of the flesh to the destruction of the soul and vice versa, that they keep running from your colleges to the slave pens of Europe, to an open collapse into the mystic muck of India, seeking any refuge against reality, any form of escape from the mind. You blank it out and cling to your hypocrisy of faith in order to blank out the knowledge that the looters have a stranglehold upon you, which consists of your moral code, that the looters are the final and consistent practitioners of the morality you're half obeying, half evading, that they practice it the only way it can be practiced, by turning the earth into a sacrificial furnace, that your morality forbids you to oppose them in the only way they can be opposed, by refusing to become a sacrificial animal and proudly asserting your right to exist, that in order to fight them to the finish and with full rectitude, it is your morality that you have to reject. You blank it out, because your self-esteem is tied to that mystic unselfishness which you've never possessed or practiced, but spent so many years pretending to possess, that the thought of denouncing it fills you with terror. No value is higher than self-esteem, but you've invested it in counterfeit securities, and now your morality has caught you in a trap where you are forced to protect your self-esteem by fighting for the creed of self-destruction. The grim joke is on you. That need of self-esteem, which you're unable to explain or to define, belongs to my morality, not yours. It's the objective token of my code. It is my proof within your own soul. By a feeling he has not learned to identify, but has derived from his first awareness of existence, from his discovery that he has to make choices, man knows that his desperate need of self-esteem is a matter of life or death. As a being of volitional consciousness, he knows that he must know his own value in order to maintain his own life. He knows that he has to be right. To be wrong in action means danger to his life. To be wrong in person, to be evil, means to be unfit for existence. Every act of man's life has to be willed. The mere act of obtaining or eating his food implies that the person he preserves is worthy of being preserved. Every pleasure he seeks to enjoy implies that the person who seeks it is worthy of finding enjoyment. He has no choice about his need of self-esteem. His only choice is the standard by which to gauge it. And he makes his fatal error when he switches this gauge, protecting his life, into the service of his own destruction, when he chooses a standard contradicting existence and sets his self-esteem against reality. Every form of causeless self-doubt, every feeling of inferiority and secret unworthiness, is in fact man's hidden dread of his inability to deal with existence. But the greater his terror, the more fiercely he clings to the murderous doctrines that choke him. No man can survive the moment of pronouncing himself irredeemably evil. Should he do it, his next moment is insanity or suicide. To escape it, if he's chosen an irrational standard, he will fake, evade, blank out. He will cheat himself of reality, of existence, of happiness, of mind. And he will ultimately cheat himself of self-esteem by struggling to preserve its illusion, rather than to risk discovering its lack. To fear to face an issue is to believe that the worst is true. It is not any crime you have ever committed that infects your soul with permanent guilt. It is none of your failures, errors, or flaws, but the blank out by which you attempt to evade them. It is not any sort of original sin or unknown prenatal deficiency, but the knowledge and fact of your basic default, of suspending your mind, of refusing to think. Fear and guilt are your chronic emotions. They are real, and you do deserve them. But they don't come from the superficial reasons you invent to disguise their cause, not from your selfishness, weakness, or ignorance, but from a real and basic threat to your existence, fear, because you have abandoned your weapon of survival, guilt, because you know you have done it volitionally.